Hey everybody, this is Eric Mueller, the host of The Eric Mueller Show. You're tuned into the podcast that explores what makes any successful person's inner clock tick by unlocking the most impactful tools within their success portfolio. I'm joined today by Michelle Johnston, an award-winning business professor whose research has shown a direct link between a team's effective communication and its financial performance. Connection drives results. Let's head on over to the interview. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Eric. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you for being here. And just a quick backstory to this, Ruth Gotian, a previous guest of the show, check out her episode if you haven't yet. She made this connection with Michelle, and we've been working for a little while to get this interview set up, so it's great to finally have you on. And Michelle, before we dive deep into this entrepreneurial story of yours and your expertise on leadership and business, we want to know what makes up your success portfolio. So if you're new to the show, allow me to define this quick. I look at it like an investment portfolio is that compilation of those investments that lay the foundation for those financial goals, maybe 401k, Roth IRA. Well, here on The Eric Mueller Show, I want to discover how successful people like Michelle invest in themselves and build that foundation for their success. So Michelle, start us off. What are some skills or traits, habits or mindsets that make up your success portfolio?
That's a great question. I love it. Thank you, Eric. Yeah, when I reflect back, I'm really grateful that I decided to get my PhD. And I pretty much went kicking and screaming. When I received my undergraduate from Auburn, I kind of knew I wanted to get a graduate degree. So I went back, got my master's and really enjoyed it. Just loved being on a college campus, loved learning, loved everything about it. But I thought I was done after that. I had my master's degree. Why do you need a PhD? And my grandfather had his PhD from Georgetown in economics. And he also was a book author. And he started a letter writing campaign saying that I really needed to get a PhD and that you could do it all. And so here I had this, you know, elderly grandfather who was literally scribbling these handwritten letters to me. Couldn't, you know, he was probably 5 years away from going to heaven. And he's scribbling saying, you really can't, do not worry about having a family, getting married, the kids, work, get your graduate degree. And that ended up being really good advice. I spent my entire 20s in college. And at age 29, I think, or 30, ended up with a PhD. And I didn't think that I would become an academic, but I did. I kind of fell into that. I initially was recruited by a consulting firm, and that's how I ended up in New Orleans, Louisiana, which is where I live now. And I loved working for a management consulting firm. I was pretty relatively young and traveling the country, delivering workshops on presentation skills, because I got my PhD in communication. So I was delivering workshops on the things that really mattered to me that I felt were important to somebody's success, like presentation skills and running meetings and team skills, listening skills. I loved all of that. And then I got recruited to teach those skills, business communication, in the business school at Loyola. So I've been doing that for years. So I really look back. And so one of the things that I invested, I'm glad I invested in, was graduate school for sure.
Yeah. And I certainly share that with you. And a lot of the listeners also probably feel the same way, that they've invested in, you know, this traditional style of education in a pretty heavy way. And it really does shape the way that you think and view the world. And I think a lot of that is really, you obviously can't go back, but it's good to hear that you don't, you know, regret that decision, and that spending that duration of time was that investment in Michelle and being able to build the foundation for the person that you were going to become. So yeah, that's a great jumping off point. And did you find that when you were in school, your definition of success molded while you were studying as a student, and did it change along the way? Or I guess, Michelle, what is success to you, and how was it, you know, when you started school versus where it is now?
Again, great question, Eric. So I just had the luxury of spending the Easter holiday with my 77-year-old father and my 18-year-old daughter. And it was so cute. We still did the scavenger hunt and the Easter egg hunt, and except at the very end, he put some Trulies instead of a chocolate. But in any case, it was very funny. And we spent hours, Eric, and I'm not exaggerating, hours at the kitchen table, just the three of us, me, the mom, the 18-year-old daughter, and the grandfather, talking about things like this. What does success look like to you? What are your values? You know, what will you be proud of when you're older? What do you want on your tombstone? What matters to you? And so I really spent some time reflecting. My father was a corporate guy, and success to him meant job security. So he had one job, General Motors, and retired with a pension, General Motors. And he still only buys General Motors cars. And he still gets mad if nobody else buys General Motors cars. Very loyal guy. And he was a turnaround guy. And so what that meant is whenever there was a market that needed turnaround, my dad was promoted. So we moved every 2 years of my life. And so he does have a regret that he moved me to four different high schools. You know, that's not good for anybody, right? But I can say that growing up as a corporate child, I loved the adventures. I loved meeting new people, the different cultures. And so I had this role model who really defined success as longevity with a company and getting promoted higher and higher and higher. And he also defined success as being a great leader. So every night, no matter how far his commutes, and sometimes when we lived outside of DC or outside of New York, his commutes were an hour and a half each way. But we had a family of four, and we would wait for dad to get home from dinner, and we would talk about General Motors and about leadership and about motivation and about teams and about culture. And that absolutely affected me in a positive way. That is what I do today. That's what I wrote my first book about, The Seismic Shift in Leadership. I'm fascinated with creating positive work environments where people can thrive. I'm fascinated by, not even fascinated, I'm tired of jerk bosses, you know?
Right.
And I grew up listening to my dad talk about all of his jerk bosses, not by name, but they didn't even know his name. You know, I mean, they would just yell at him and he felt like he was a grunt. So all of that really impacted me. So I know what success was to my dad and what motivated him. And I totally understand. And I totally forgive him for moving me around so much because that made me who I am today. I feel like I'm open and resilient. However, on the flip side, it took me a long time to figure out who I was because I became really, really good at fitting in, adapting. And finally, when I lifted my head up and I was teaching an MBA class at Loyola, I was so used to just trying to fit in that I was acting like all the other faculty members and I was not genuine and authentic. So it took me a while to kind of connect with myself, which really was the foundation of all of my research. My research is on how can you be the very best version of yourself as a leader. First and foremost, it's about connection with yourself and making sure you are showing up authentically so that people trust you, so that you can create this environment with psychological safety that drives empowerment and innovation, which ultimately equals financial performance. So that's my whole research is I believe that the foundation is connection. So what does success look like to me? Success looks like making an impact in this world and getting rid of jerk bosses. Success looks like helping leaders create these positive work environments where people can connect, where they don't feel so isolated. I was on a call recently, Eric, with Dr. Bob, who wrote the book, The Good Life, and it's based on the longest study at Harvard looking at happiness. And right now, or at least when the study was published, which is just this year, 300 million adults identified as unhappy and lonely.
Wow.
And the good news is, his research shows that just one meaningful interaction a day can make a positive difference. And that's what my whole mission is. I want to help leaders. I want to help organizations create cultures of connection where people really are, they feel connected. They feel connected with themselves, where they can show up genuinely and authentically. They feel connected with their teams. They're proud of the work they do, and they're connected with the organization's mission. That, to me, is success.
Yeah, that's very clear-cut and well-defined, and that's I'm glad to hear that you have that in your mind, because I think coming from traditional schooling and, you know, being a professor like yourself too, and I'm not a professor, but I have taught, at least at the university level, you kind of get your mind trained in a way of what is success, and it's very metric based. You know, you get a 90%, you get an A, you get an 89%, you get a B+, you know, and so on and so forth. So I felt, you know, I kind of had a seismic shift, so to speak, about 2 years ago after I finished pharmacy school and was like, you know, I've got to figure out what success means to me because I'm no longer a student. And, you know, it led to things like this podcast and different side hustles. And it really kind of like you were sharing, it took a little while to find your way and not be like, you know, everybody else and be you, because you need to be Michelle, or you need to be Eric, or you need to be insert name of the listener right now. And so I want to talk about leadership a little bit in regard to, you know, are they born or are they made? Have you found in your experience, is a leader, you know, is it an innate quality, or is it really truly something that you can teach a person?
Do you know that is the question most asked of me at cocktail parties? I teach, I'm a leadership professor. I write books on leadership. I'm an executive coach. And they say, Michelle, are leaders born or made? And the answer is, I wouldn't be in this profession as a leadership professor and an executive coach and an author of books now on leadership if I didn't truly believe that you could teach leadership. You can teach the hard stuff of communication. And please note, I said that intentionally, the hard stuff of communication. I'm really tired of communication being framed as the soft skills, because they really are the most difficult to me. And from what I can tell with leaders, people say that I coach a bunch of really fantastic CEOs. And they said, Michelle, my God, I need a psychology degree. I wish if I could go back and get that. And they all have law degrees and MBAs. And they're like, I need a psychology degree, because it really is, your success is a function of how you lead people and your emotional intelligence. In any case, yes. So are leaders born or made? I believe that some kids come out of the womb with assertiveness and confidence, and they're going to be the alpha, whether they're a male or a female. They're going to be the one that people follow naturally. I also have seen that there are real, there's a combination called the introverted action-oriented leader, which tends to be kind of, they have the secret sauce. A lot of the high-level leaders are introverts, and they think a lot about processes and systems and the details, but they're not naturally going to be on stage, you know, winning over a crowd, but those skills can be taught. And that's what I spend a lot of time with my leaderships teaching. I can teach them the executive communication skills for sure. So are leaders born or made? I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. And you recently released your first book, and you mentioned the seismic shift in leadership. Now that word seismic, like that literally means of enormous proportions. Walk us through the massive shift that leadership that you discovered and you identified that led to that book. What's that story behind that, Michelle? What caused you to write that in the first place?
It is enormous. And I feel so blessed, Eric, because the book came out. The book was supposed to come out in March of 2020. And here, my entire thesis about the seismic shift in leadership was, whoa, watch out, everybody. That old command and control jerk boss, which we were all so used to, and it was the norm, that is no longer effective. And so I knew it wasn't working, because I was watching, as an executive coach, many leaders, some of which I was coaching, get pushed out of organizations because they were just jerks. They were too aggressive. They got the results the company wanted, but then they got to a certain level in a company and they couldn't manage people and they couldn't go any higher and people didn't want to work for them. And they inadvertently created cultures of fear. And that was one of my big takeaways, like, whoa, these jerk bosses, which was, again, incredibly normal, the way that they led, that command and control and micromanaging and just say what I do and I'm just going to give you orders. And it was very transactional. I mean, that at one point was seen as effective. And then all of a sudden the seismic shift happened and people were being a little bit more honest and forthcoming and saying, these leaders have created cultures of fear, which is stifling innovation. And so once people started to speak up and say, I don't want to work here anymore, that's what happened with the pandemic. So March of 2020, I have this book written. It took me years. When I realized that there was a seismic shift and command and control wasn't working, I then went and interviewed 18 leaders from around the world to truly understand what the new model looked like. And it was all about connection. So here I was about to publish my first book, and it's March of 2020, and the whole world goes on lockdown. And I called my publisher. I said, I cannot publish a book on connection when this is the first time in this planet's history, on our mother Earth, that the entire planet is disconnected.
Right.
So I said, I need to go back and I'm going to go back and I'm going to interview all of these leaders. And I got to interview half of them again. I went back in order to understand how truly to connect in a disconnected world. And so when the book was published, which was last year, we all were coming out of the pandemic. We were feeling isolated. We were feeling lonely. And ultimately, we felt disconnected. So I think that's why this book made it to number two on Amazon in leadership, because A, the timing, and B, the message. We all were coming out of this crazy time, understanding more than ever before, we wanted positive work environments. We didn't want to work for jerk bosses or unethical organizations. We wanted to feel good about what we did. And that was all based on connection. So I'm so grateful that my book just came out when it did, and that I went back and really learned more about how to connect in a disconnected world, because I believe that this hybrid environment is not going away. So connection is more important than ever before. And we also hear from employees, they have more power than ever before. They know it and they want flexibility. So we as leaders are trying to figure out, how in the world do I connect on Zoom? How in the world do I connect now that people are saying, I'm not going to work on Mondays and Fridays. I'm only going to come in 2.5 days a week. And so that's what we're trying to figure out. And connection is key.
Right. And congratulations on the book launch. Congratulations on the Amazon bestseller. That's extremely exciting. A wonderful milestone. We'll have it tagged in the show notes for people to access that and purchase the book. And, you know, so Michelle, if we look at the results that are driven by connection, you know, we think about the barriers, like you mentioned, the disconnected world we were in with the pandemic. You know, it still exists in some aspect, but even just in in-person workplaces, there are barriers just being in person and working with people. What are some of the most common barriers to that connection that you've seen in those interviews and interactions with leaders? And how have they overcome them? How have they persevered through it to connect with all their, you know, people in a way that progresses towards that result for the company?
Yeah, here's what I think and what I've discovered through my research and observation. There are three levels of connection for you to master as a good leader. So the first level of connection is connection with yourself. The barriers that I saw that were pushing people out of organizations is there were leaders who weren't connected with themselves and they were trying to be somebody that they weren't. So they were showing up with, I call it perfection equals disconnection. So they were trying to be perfect, whatever perfect looked like to them. They were trying to be successful, but trying to be somebody else. So they had their walls up and they were trying to be perfect. And so again, perfection equals disconnection. So that's the first barrier in true connection, is showing up as inauthentic and not genuine. So the first thing you can do is really own your story. And I learned that through Brené Brown's research and her book on the gifts of imperfection, is we're all imperfect and we shouldn't strive to be perfect. And the way you show up authentically is just to own your stuff. Own your story, own your brand, own your narrative, know who you are. And I'm not saying that that means you show up at the office like, hey, everybody, this is me, accept all of me, warts and all, in self-disclosure and oversharing, not at all. I just mean you need to do a lot of work on yourself, a lot of reflection, understanding what your strengths are, your superpowers, what your blind spots are, and really being able to lean into you and find a job that celebrates your strengths. So that's the first level of connection with yourself. The second level is connection with your team. Some of the barriers that I saw that leaders were not good with is they just would show up to meetings in person or on Zoom, and it was all about results, 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 results. What are your goals? Did you make your goals? Why not? You know, shaming. I saw so many meetings where the leader never once looked around and said, how are you all? How was your week? How was your Easter? How was your Easter? Let's go around, you know, let me see. I'm curious. How are y'all doing? And so those leaders who just focused only on business results and didn't see their people as humans really ended up failing. And again, we saw that a lot in the pandemic. I was working with Qualcomm and flying out to San Diego anytime there was a respite between the variants of COVID. And I would fly out and Don McGuire is the chief marketing officer, and he and I were working together, and he'd fly his people in from all over the world because they hadn't met in person. We had the couple of weeks in between variants in order to disrupt. So his goal was, Michelle, I want us to create a new world of work. We are the leading technology company in the world. I want us to do things differently. If not now, then when? I said, okay, I hear you, but we can't just bring all these people together that never met, have never worked together, have never even sat in the same room, and expect them to feel comfortable and safe enough just to blow everything up at Qualcomm. I said, we've got to build connection. We've got to understand each other's stories so that we don't assume the worst. We've got to work on team dynamics and psychological safety and trust. So what we learned through all of that work with Qualcomm is that when you have a team meeting, whether it's on Zoom or in person, you really do have to begin with some sort of connection question. You know, again, just tell me, what did you do at Easter? I'd love to hear. We're talking 10 minutes. 15 at the most out of your meeting to show your people that you care. So at the very end of 2 years of doing this together, Don and I, my book then had finally come out and it had just hit number two. He goes, Michelle, fly out and let's do a fireside chat and I'll buy your, you can sign books for everybody and we can open it up for questions and answers. I said, great. So I flew back to San Diego. Don McGuire and I had this fireside chat. At the very end, we opened it up for questions and answers. And one lady said, I just want to thank both of you. We said, why? I said, absolutely, but why? She said, for 2 years during the pandemic, I worked for another company and a boss who never, ever, ever once asked me, not once. And she said, I was alone in my apartment on lockdown, very strict California rules, all by myself. I'd never been so depressed, so isolated, but he never once asked me, how are you doing? She said, I finally got the courage to leave, and I feel so grateful that I'm with a company that truly believes in connection. I mean, there you go, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's such a common story. I feel like the people that felt that disconnection and you know, you hear the saying and probably see it on social media that people quit bad managers, they don't quit bad jobs. And so that's it. And so it's like people quit people. They don't quit the task. They don't quit the goal. So I think, you know, I try to think of it in probably the most easy to understand way would be, you know, when you're in school, when you are a student, you're in direct control of those results and you probably don't have to interact with a ton of people, you know, maybe you have group projects, but it's on you. So you need to go outside the box and access resources like Michelle's book or listening to podcasts, you know, listening to other people who have spoken with the leaders that are walking the walk and they are, you know, they're doing it in a way that it works. Otherwise, you won't advance further, like you mentioned. I mean, you hit a peak and it's like, this person doesn't know how to talk to people. Like, we can't promote them to the CEO. I mean, we can't have them leading a keynote. You know, people aren't going to want to hear that. And it's not going to reflect our company that we want to show. So on top of that, you know, if the most important quality that a leader could emulate would be a good connector, a good communicator, maybe. What's the number one thing that a leader could do to cultivate this quality? If we're saying that leaders are made and not born, what would be the very first step if you have someone who's listening who is not at the level of leadership they want to be, but they have hopes and dreams to, you know, to rise up and be a really, really influential person and motivate people? What would be the first step for them, Michelle?
So I want them to realize that communication is primarily transactional. So the old way of leadership was transactional. It was just a leader directing and controlling, right? The new way to be effective as a leader is about reciprocity. So connection is about a shared experience. So the leaders who are super successful right now actually do less talking and more listening. They begin their meetings with questions, getting to know their people. They make it about their people. So I would say, listen first, show care and concern for the whole person, the people who work for you. Right? And then act more as a servant leader. And the way you do that is to recognize that your job, if you're a high-level leader, is to remove barriers for your people, to support your people, to develop your people, mentor your people. I had one of the leaders I interviewed in my book, David. He was the CEO of a hospital in Lafayette, Louisiana. And he said, Michelle, the first thing I would do when I would come to a new company is, he goes, I would go on a listening tour, because he was one of those turnaround guys as well. So he had lots. He would come in and turn around a hospital. He goes, I'd go on a listening tour. I'd figure out the toxic people, see if I could get them out. I would put the really positive people together in task forces and put them in charge, empower them to make the changes necessary. He said, and then I would give a big speech and I would show them the organizational chart and I'd turn it upside down. And I'd say, usually the CEO is at the top, but I'm here to tell you the way I lead is I'm at the bottom supporting you. So success to me is when you all thrive. Success to me is to empower you. So it really is a change, a shift in orientation of how we used to see leadership as at the top, directing and controlling. And now we see it as more servant leadership, leaning in, showing care and compassion.
Yeah, that's a perfect correlation with Gary Vee. I'm a big Gary Vaynerchuk fan. And that's his whole thing is as a CEO, they don't work for you, you work for them. And I've always loved that because that is the way I view it. And I think that, you know, and I've always viewed, you know, if someone asks a strength in a job interview, I'll generally say like communication in a way that, you know, I feel like I was raised by my parents in a way to know how to interact with people and kind of in an authentic way, mold myself to a scenario to know how to get the best out of a certain person and bring their potential out. And so it's not something that I don't think I could, you know, become an executive coach like yourself and teach someone how I've done that. It's more like probably a combination of an innate quality, but also being in the right environment. And you can put yourself in the right environment by using resources like your book and by talking to people like you have that have done it. So what do you think is the biggest challenge that a person will face as a seasoned leader who maybe is, you know, kind of maybe more stuck in the way of how it used to be? Is there a tool? Is there some type of strategy that they can implement to not allow themselves to fall back into that comfort and you know, kind of rest on their laurels of how it used to work?
Yeah, that's really, that's the biggest pushback I get now, Eric, is from kind of old school leaders who, I was just on a radio show recently with the Tommy Tucker show. And he's like, Michelle, I used to see my paycheck as the reward. That's all I needed, my paycheck. And now employees have so much power and they need all these things and all of these benefits. And I want to do yoga and I want to, you know, I don't want to work Fridays. And so what I'm here to say is this is a hard shift. It's not easy because there are lots of old people are scared. Change is hard. And I think the older leaders are scared that the employees have so much power and they're scared that they're not going to be as productive. But all the research is showing us that by giving employees flexibility and creating a more positive workspace increases productivity and it increases retention. And ultimately, it increases the bottom line. So the good news is for me is connection does drive financial performance. Connection does drive results. It does pay off. So for the leaders who are a little bit scared to give up control, you gotta trust. Just take the risk and trust your people. Give them the flexibility, the autonomy that they want, empower them, and your mind will be blown at what they do. You have to let go of the reins.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of my very first interview guest who is from my same hometown of Winona, Minnesota, Mr. Bob Kierlin, one of the founders of Fastenal Company. My dad has worked for the company for most of his career. You know, it's a really inspirational story of how that company was founded. And his entire philosophy, Michelle, was about bringing out the best in people. You know, and this is a company founded, you know, several decades ago. And he was so in front of, I think, where people realized you had to be. And that's why his company was successful. And it kind of makes me think, you know, furthermore on this point of, let's say you have a leader that's doing everything right. Let's say you have a Mr. Bob Kierlin that, you know, has the right principles in place. And then 20 years later, his company is going public and you have a whole other network of people that are coming in, you know, not as founding members, people that weren't the first employee, you know, that probably have other, you know, strategies in mind about how they think things should be done. How can a leader at the very top, you know, be able to cascade down those good principles that they want to have remain in place, you know, even when they're gone, even when they decide to leave the company in a traditional sense?
So that's what my next book is going to be, how to create cultures of connection that drive performance. So it's one thing to know now, my first book, The Seismic Shift in Leadership, was making the case. The old way of leading is no longer effective. We've got to do it differently, and we've got to lean in with a little bit more care and compassion and positivity. My next book is about how to do it. So what are the accelerators that drive connection? And what are the things that can kill it overnight? And one of the things I learned when I was in Atlanta a couple weeks ago collecting data is that you can spend all the time in the world, like this leader that you're referring to, built a company and now doesn't, you know, wants to leave it in really good shape. You could spend years building this beautiful culture, but unless you hold your people accountable, You can kill it overnight. So that's one of the pieces of advice I give my people is don't think that this is all gushy, soft stuff. Oh, build a culture of connection. No, I mean, build this incredible culture where people feel safe, trusted to go and take risks and to drive innovation and improve their productivity and be held accountable and manage expectations and have difficult conversations. It all goes together. You have to have one to have the other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does. It's kind of like, it's kind of drawing the line and balancing between, you know, not a culture of fear, but a culture of respect. And really, it's kind of like maybe a parental relationship that you have with your kids. And I'm not a parent yet, but that's certainly what I would want is I don't want my child to be scared of me, but I do want them to respect me and know that there is a certain boundary where if you cross that, that's not okay. Because, you know, from a safety standpoint as a parent or, you know, for an employee, you know, there could be legal issues. There could be, you know, you could be working with clients that have different cultural backgrounds and you want people to be emotionally intelligent too. So that kind of leads me into a next part about, you know, emotional intelligence or being able to, you know, kind of know where you're at in terms of how you interact with others. Are you a fan of, you know, like the Myers-Briggs assessments or Strength Finders? Do you find that those things are helpful or do you feel like it brings the individuality of a person down? Do you think it puts them in a box where they, you know, maybe feel like they have a barrier, you know, built around where their potential could be?
I believe the more assessments you complete and take, the better. Myers-Briggs, StrengthsFinder, I came up with one called the Communication Preference Profile. The more, there's one with colors. I mean, the more the better, because the more you truly understand your natural tendencies, your natural preferences, the way that you default, the way that you lead by default, the more you know yourself, and your blind spots, you can build a team to complement what you're not good at. So if you're a big picture, make sure you have high content people, high detailed people on your team. If I had, as a matter of fact, I had a coaching call with one of my leaders today, and he said, "Michelle, remember when I took your communication assessment?" I said, "Yes." He said, "And remember I was high content?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "And the guy I had to work with was the opposite, high action?" I said, "Yes." He goes, "And I got so mad at him because I would send these incredibly lengthy emails with all the research I had done. And all he would reply is either yes or no. And it would drive me crazy." He said, "And finally, you got us together and you mediated a meeting." He said, "Do you remember that?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, and he said, "Please," I'll call this guy Tom. He said, "Please, Tom, don't write war and peace every time you send an email. I'm action oriented. Just give me two bullet points. And if you really feel the need to put all the details, then do it at the end." And then my guy said, "Okay, we'll call him Charlie. Okay, Charlie, well, when you reply, could you just say thank you, appreciate your hard work, you know, say something other than yes or no?" So my point in bringing all this up is the more you understand your tendencies, the more you can understand that other people don't see the world like you do, don't communicate like you do, and there's got to be a compromise. You have to build a team that complements you. So no, I don't think that taking all of those inventories and tests and, you know, ends up hindering you at all. I think it allows you to grow.
Perfect. Yeah. And you mentioned the communication preference profile, which you created along with yourself and Dr. Kitty Watson. I'll tag that in the show notes too. People, you can go on there and purchase that. It's only $19.99. So really inexpensive compared to the other options out there. I plan on taking that myself to figure out am I as good at communication as I think I might be? So, you know, you need to be open and transparent with yourself of where you're at. And it did remind me, Michelle, of, you know, that when you talk about building that team and getting the right people on board with an idea or a mission or a goal, it made me think of, you know, how in school, let's go back to traditional schooling, and I'm not bashing on traditional schooling at all. I just noticed there's certain trends where it causes you to think in a certain way to succeed in those environments. And, you know, let's take a class where you need to write a paper. There might be a minimum requirement of pages in that paper. And I think it might be Elon Musk that says that, or I've seen something out there with his name on it where it's like, if you're required to write 3 pages, but you can describe it in 2 sentences, don't waste my time. Just tell me exactly what it is, be straight to the point, because that's kind of how it is in the real world. So it's kind of going back to, you know, the kind of the overarching theme of this conversation, really the balance that you need to bring into your interactions and into your connection. And you need to realize that people come from different backgrounds. So you might have someone that wants to write a super long email like that, And they're not expecting you to reply with a massive email in response, but they do want to feel acknowledged and connected with and respected. And so I think that's a great story. And I want to ask you one final question. And it kind of comes from the background of you being an executive coach and talking and working with, you know, really high level individuals that are leading organizations. What is a myth about leadership that you want to debunk on the podcast today? What is something that people believe is true, but it is not, and you want to say, do not fall for the false belief of that myth?
That you have to be a hard ass. You know, I excuse my language, but I think a lot of us just think, well, if I'm going to be CEO, oh my gosh, you know, I've got to be this unbelievably, you know, almost like a drill sergeant. And that's just not the case at all. The leaders who were like that, who would call people out and shame them for getting something wrong and berate them and make them feel awful. I mean, those people are walking around with PTSD to this day. Those are not healthy environments at all, where your people end up thriving. Your people end up just being scared. So yeah, you don't have to be that military drill sergeant. As a matter of fact, even at West Point, they're changing their leadership. I coach with a great guy named Greg Hebert, and he has his Harvard MBA and went to West Point. And he said, even they're changing now. You know, you have to have the right systems, the right processes. You have to have the brain power. You got to know your business and know the goals and how to get there. And you can do it in a way that is positive and kind and motivating all at the same time without being a jerk. So no more jerk bosses.
No more jerk bosses. I'm on board with that. And I think everyone listening would also be on board with that, whether they're an employee right now, whether they're going to be, you know, leaving a traditional job and leading others. You want to be that person that's looked on in a favorable sense, that can be the motivator to your team and not drag them down. So Michelle Johnson, thank you so much for spending the time and sharing all these tidbits of information. We'll tag your book, your podcast, you know, all the wonderful resources that you have in the show notes. If someone wants to reach out to you and learn more and connect with you on a more personal level, what would be the best way to do that?
Yeah, please give me contact me on my website, michellekjohnston.com, michellekjohnston. I would love to hear from you and tell me your thoughts on things that build connection and things that break it. I would love to hear from you all. And Eric, you were a fabulous host. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure. It was worth the wait to get you scheduled, and I really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to that next book. And I'm excited to see where the future holds for you. It sounds like you're up to a lot of cool things, and we're excited to share that journey with you.
Thank you so much.